right, so my name is John Stone. I'm from the University of Illinois. I work in the Theoretical and Computational Biophysics Group. And what I do for my day job is I write molecular visualization software that runs on Linux machines, among many others. And one of the things I've been involved with over the last year and a half, 2 years, is doing scientific computations on graphics processing units. And this is a relatively young field, not, it's just sort of starting to emerge now. So I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about how this field developed and where it's going and what people can do using GPUs. So to give you sort of a background, since I don't know how much everybody knows about graphics boards, video cards, how they've been developed over the last 20 years. Basically, the earliest graphics boards did very simple things. They could draw vector graphics, lines, things like this. They were built with discrete logic, very simple hardware. As these things got progressively more complex, they could draw things like triangles, they could do actual shading of the lines and polygons that they were rendering, and later on they could do things like texture mapping. In the old days, this stuff was so difficult to do in hardware that they had to keep the hardware very simple, and so it was a very fixed function. It did exactly one thing and one thing only. So if you're familiar with instruction sets, graphics boards are the ultimate in simplicity. They could really draw only like two primitives. They could draw pixels and they could draw triangles. Anything else had to be expressed in the form of those types of primitives, even things like lines. A line is basically a degenerate triangle. That's how you draw lines in hardware. Anyway, so as the graphics industry, and in particular games, which are a huge dominating force driving the development of successive generations of commodity graphics boards, as games developed and started using more sophisticated algorithms, there was an increasing demand to add sophisticated shading algorithms and basically continuing to improve and revise this graphics hardware. Now, as you can imagine, if it's implemented in dedicated logic, it is very expensive to make any changes to this logic. It takes a lot of engineers, a lot of time to design these special purpose high-speed circuits. And when you add new functions to it, it costs you a lot of money and it delays your ability to ship a new product. So ultimately, it became desirable to replace many of these fixed function pieces of hardware with programmable units. Now, they were very simple. In the earliest days, they could only do things like add a couple of numbers, maybe multiply by another number, things like that, and only in certain stages of the rendering pipeline, the hardware system that draws these triangles on the screen. As they continue to revise these circuits, now we're in a situation today where basically the whole graphics board, something about 90% of the chip is now fully programmable hardware, and maybe only 10% of the chip or so is spent on dedicated circuitry that is entirely graphics specific or has only one purpose. And the few things that are left are just things that are very difficult to implement efficiently with the required performance and general purpose hardware, but that's where things are going. Eventually we will get to the point where graphics boards consist of nothing but a huge array of programmable processors and maybe a few special memory systems, and that'll be it. So this really began in the late 80s with a couple of groundbreaking machine designs. One was done by AT&T called the AT&T Pixel Machine. It had a large array of digital signal processors combined in a way that would allow you to run a massively parallel program and compute the values of the pixels that were then displayed on the screen. This was one of the first machines that could do things like real-time ray tracing. They could actually write a ray tracer in assembly language, and that would run on these little DSPs, and if they had enough DSPs, they could actually do ray tracing in the late 80s in real time. Interactive rotation of reflective spheres with shadows, all kinds of things that we have never seen in commodity hardware and more recently. Later on, University of North Carolina Chapel Hill built this big machine here called Pixelflow, which is a huge rack of programmable hardware. It combined HP PA RISC processors, these are the CPUs that were used in HP's Unix workstations of that time. They were RISC machines. And they combined those, they did all the vertex processing, geometric transformations, basically deciding how to draw the triangles and things on the screen. And then the actual pixel level operations were done with 8192-bit serial SIMD processors that were basically just doing the per pixel logic. These were connected in a big ring network, and so you could engage with a simple program, you know, thousands of these floating point units together to do very computationally demanding rendering processes. In fact, as a result of the existence of this dedicated hardware and the architecture designs that they did at UNC, this is what actually began in a big way the trend towards the programmable hardware that we have now. Some of the other machines that had a degree of programmability as well, the earliest SGI reality engine boards, these are the first boards that were the basis of what ultimately became OpenGL. So they developed the graphics architecture, which is now OpenGL, on these boards. But back in those days, they weren't really sure which features they were going to keep, which features would have to be revised. And so in those days, it was more cost-effective to use programmable processing units for a large portion of the front end of this graphics accelerator. And they could change microcode and write assembly language to alter how things behaved, and they could fix bugs. And this is a lot, you know, with programmable processors, if you have a bug in your rendering system, you can just change a few machine instructions and the bug's gone. If you build dedicated hardware, oops, now I have to make a whole new chip, and that's tremendously more expensive. So eventually, they did SGI for performance reasons, eventually replaced the programmable stages with dedicated hardware. But what's important to note is, you know, when you're designing things and you don't know where it's going to go, the programmability gives you a lot of flexibility. And that is how we got OpenGL today. So anyway, the point now is basically every GPU that you can buy from the lowest end simple graphics boards all the way up to the top of the line boards that AMD and NVIDIA make, they all have entirely programmable processors. And so now I'm going to tell you a little bit about what these are used for in their original context in terms of rendering. So with the old fixed function OpenGL pipeline, we could draw things composed of millions of little triangles. And the way OpenGL worked is you would draw a mesh of triangles and calculate the colors of the three vertices of each triangle. The problem with that is if you have something, a surface like this one, that has a lot of kinks and bends in it and things like this, it is unlikely that you'll dice this into enough triangles to accurately show the surface reflections the way they would be seen on a very glossy surface. In contrast, if we actually, so instead of representing this as a massive collection of triangles where we only calculate colors of each vertex, if we instead actually compute the colors accurately to every single pixel, you can see we get a much better looking image. So this is done in real time as well, but the quality is akin to what you would get from a ray tracer like Havre or something of that ilk. And the cool part is we can actually do arbitrary complex calculations on every pixel now, and this is what has allowed the game programmers to do tremendously complex visual effects, explosions, all sorts of complex transparency and things like this. And this will be how they do physics and a whole bunch of other calculations as well. So since my day job is writing molecular visualization software, what I am doing is typically drawing atoms. So here's a few examples. To draw these spheres so that they actually look round requires about 512 triangles. Another way I can do this with programmable shading is to draw a box around the area volume of the sphere, and then I run a little pixel program on every pixel contained in that box. And I actually run, it's like running a little ray tracer on that little box. And the beauty is the CPU has a tiny fraction of the amount of work. And in this case, the CPU is the weak link. The CPU is far too slow to be moving and animating millions of atoms on a continuing basis when we're viewing one of the results of the big simulation. By doing these calculations on the GPU, the amount of information that has to be transmitted from the host down to the GPU is divided by a factor of a couple orders of magnitude, but getting pretty close. So, you know, from 512 triangles down to 12, so it's a huge improvement in the amount of data that has to be sent. If I have a million atom structure, this is a huge savings in the amount of data that has to be sent. Now, there are other ways of achieving that with OpenGL, but the other factor is This sphere always looks round, no matter how far I zoom in. It's always perfectly round. It's always shaded nicely. And so this has inherent advantages over the other scheme. So this is really cool. And this is what we're able to do now, but in a few years, we'll be able to do far more than this, graphically speaking. So, you know, it sounds somewhat arcane running a program in every pixel, but basically you run a shader. They're written in, this is OpenGL shading language. It's basically a dialect of C. So you have a few strange things, like you'll see those VEC3 types. This is just three floats. So it's like a float array of three. There are a few unusual things like that. There are a few special variable names that have special meaning to OpenGL. But it's basically writing C code. So there's no mystery here. It's pretty straightforward. And so this is actually compiled on the fly. When you send this text, you actually send the program text to the video driver. It is compiled at runtime, just like if you think of Java or something like that. It compiles the shader from source. The beauty of that is the GPU manufacturers are not stuck with a particular machine code or instruction syntax or anything like that. If NVIDIA builds a new GPU next year, and they decide to have a new instruction set and a new machine architecture, they can write a new compiler to translate these shaders, and immediately they will get the better performance. They will not be held back by what they did 3 years ago. And that's actually a very exciting thing about GPUs, since they did things with this just-in-time compile from the very beginning. They will have a tremendous advantage going forward. You're always compiling to the most optimal machine code representation, so it runs with very high performance.
Did SGI used to do this as well?
So SGI's hardware was never this programmable. So this is actually sort of after the sunset of SGI's big graphics hardware development efforts. So by the time this stuff came along, SGI had really gotten out of the business of building their own graphics boards, and they had started using chips from ATI and NVIDIA in their big machines. Now, you know, I'm sure they had stuff in their labs that could do all of this. They did have, before they stopped making the big infinite reality machines, they did have a project they called OpenGL Shader, which was a software-based implementation. So rather than doing this in the low-level graphics board hardware, they did this, they interpreted shaders, not to this degree of complexity. They couldn't have branch statements, they couldn't have loops, they couldn't do all the things that we can do now. But they could do fairly complex shaders by rendering things in multiple passes using low-level pixel arithmetic on each successive pass. And they could build up an image composed of many complex operations that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. And so my answer is they couldn't do this, but they could do something that was a predecessor of this in a sort of roundabout way using a multi-pass rendering technique. But it was nowhere near as efficient as this approach is. And, the ability to have these dynamic statements, having branching, having if statements, having loops, this increases the flexibility of these shaders tremendously. And it also means if I'm a game developer, I don't have to write 100 shaders for the different variations of the way something might look. I can just have a flag and just say, shiny flag is true, and it runs this other shader. Or in this case, in VMD, I have an optimization for the depth code. It depends on whether there's a perspective projection or if it's an orthographic projection. The equations are slightly different. So, otherwise I'd have to have two totally different shaders. This way I only have to debug one and maintain one. So that's another reason we wanted shading languages to be much more closely aligned with the typical programming language. So the result of this, by the time we got to the level of sophistication I've just shown you, where we really had more of a normal looking programming language and so on, early researchers, this is about, I'd say 2004 is when we got to the point I just described here. That was the bleeding edge at that time. So a few people started playing with this and they thought, I can write arbitrarily complex shaders. Maybe I can do an actual calculation this way. So they did this, but in that time period, the only way to use the GPU for calculations was to actually draw whatever it is that you were trying to calculate. Now, you can imagine that if you're trying to do physics, drawing triangles doesn't really relate at all to whatever it is you're trying to calculate. Doing an FFT transform by drawing triangles is rather counterintuitive, I'd say. So the problem with that is it placed a huge impediment in the way of the community to be able to use these GPUs for anything serious. Because A, you have to be a graphics expert to do anything at all. And B, the other problem is, what are these commodity devices sold for? They're sold for Quake, right? So the problem is they optimize the video drivers to produce the fastest frame rate possible. And if that means they take a shortcut and they give you a numerical approximation that has one less significant bit, nobody will notice if it's only on this, or if it has a bug where you occasionally get a black pixel on the screen in the middle of your 150,000 frame rate Quake game, while you're blowing your opponent away, you'll hardly even notice that one pixel turned black that wasn't supposed to be, or you got an odd number as a result. Nobody's going to notice it quick. But if you're trying to do a serious calculation with this hardware, you can't have the compiler doing, unlimited optimizations that could give you incorrect answers. And particularly, it's problematic if every vendor has different hacks like this. There's no way for you to trust that you can actually do a numerically correct calculation in those conditions. It's perfectly adequate for drawing stuff on the screen, especially if you make a small bug like this and it disappears in a hundredth of a second. You will never notice it, but it isn't what we need for computation. So, to get past that, we had to basically develop new programming languages that were, sort of computation specific, where we could guarantee the accuracy of the results that were being calculated, and that would use standard IEEE floating point types and integers and so on. That was another limitation. The early languages didn't even have an integer; they only had floating point. That's a strange, that's a strange limitation to have. But anyway, so that's the thing: is we needed a real serious programming language that you could trust. So where we're at now is we now have, I think, as of now, we have something like 80 million GPUs that are in the field that can run, real calculations with IEEE floating point, standard 32-bit and 64-bit floating point. These things have hundreds of processing units in them. The latest NVIDIA cards have 240 processing units in them. I think the AMD cards have somewhere around 800. They're a little bit different, and so the way you count, they're not equivalent numbering schemes, but the point is you have a huge number of parallel processors on these devices, and now you can write code in limited dialects of C and C++, so just like the shading language I just showed, except that these are more like C and less of a hack. They have limitations, which I'll tell you a little bit about in a minute when we get to the hardware. So another thing that's interesting is, by the time you port your code to a GPU, because they do have various hardware limitations, because you have hundreds of these processors, they really don't use things like caches in the same way that the CPU does. So there has to be a high locality of reference within the code. By the time you get your code working well on a GPU, usually the same code also runs very, very well on the CPU. So that's a nice side effect. There's a group at University of Illinois that's written a tool called MCUDA that actually automatically translates the GPU code to run on a multi-core CPU. That's actually freely available and open source. And I think NVIDIA, in the next release of CUDA, there will be a -multi-core option on their CUDA compiler that will automatically generate multi-threaded code from the CUDA by itself. So the big question everybody asks me when they, they're trying out GPUs for their own purposes for the first time is, what sort of speedups can they get using one of these massively parallel devices to do their calculations? And I would say that the general rule of thumb I give people is it's reasonable to expect a speedup of between 8 and 30 times faster for the part of the code that you run on the GPU. If you have a piece of code that does a lot of transcendental functions, exponentials, instructions like that, those are actually things where a GPU has a tremendous advantage because they're used in shading all the time. So we use exponentials for those specular highlights, things like that. Those calculations are actually implemented as hardware instructions on a GPU, whereas on a CPU, that's a function call, a table lookup, some interpolation, maybe a couple of iterations of Newton Raphson to give you the right answer. And so you have a huge performance advantage for things like that, that are hardware instruction on one and software on the other. So that's another issue. And the other thing is SSE has a few limitations that are sort of, you know, in the modern context, seem a little silly that they still have these limitations, where they can't do branching and things like that, whereas the GPU can. So that's another interesting thing. But one big thing you have to keep in mind is Amdahl's law. Well, Amdahl's law says if you have a, let's say you have a problem, whatever it is you're trying to speed up, some operation, if the part of that problem that you run on the parallel processor, let's say it's 80% of the total problem, right? So if you make that go infinitely fast, so that time collapses to zero, that still leaves 20% that wasn't sped up. So that means even if you do a perfect job running that on a parallel processor, the best speed up in that case that you can hope to achieve is a factor of 5. Even if it, you know, even if you collapse the 80% of the runtime to zero, you still have that 20%. So that's the best speed up you can get. So this is a big consideration in terms of what your hopes are for achieving tremendous acceleration using a GPU or an FPGA or a cell processor or whatever. That's the limiting factor. So if you have a program that spends its time in 1,000 little tiny functions, that's a scenario where it's going to be very difficult to get any significant speed up from a GPU. If you have a program that spends its time in a few key algorithms, maybe one or two big algorithms where there's a huge amount of work in one or two algorithms, then you can get a significant speed up from a GPU or another accelerator. So just so you know, where does that speed up come from? Well, part of it is GPUs have a huge performance advantage over CPUs, and this is because where the CPU has maybe 4 cores and each one has a few floating point units, the GPU has hundreds or thousands of floating point units, and it's able to do these arithmetic operations at a rate that's 10 or 20 times faster than the fastest CPU you can buy. So this is sort of a plot of that trend over time. This, when you think about it, this isn't actually that surprising. In order to shade all those triangles in that Quake game at hundreds of frames a second, they're at every single pixel, or at least every single vertex, they've had to be, have been doing all of those transcendental function calls, multiplies, adds, all in floating point arithmetic. And in particular with the modern GPUs, now we're doing all these things not at every vertex, but every pixel. And so it's not surprising that we have almost a teraflop of computational capability on one GPU. So you can imagine a cluster of GPUs is even better. Another thing that a GPU has a big advantage on is memory bandwidth. This is something that most people don't think about. But one of the limitations, if you're doing a simple array calculation, let's say you have a little for loop, and you have a few arrays like A of I equals B of I plus C of I. There isn't much of floating point arithmetic, it's actually quite simple. The problem with that sort of calculation is it uses a tremendous amount of memory bandwidth. So in that kind of calculation, it's going to be the memory bandwidth that limits your performance. And so this is another area where GPUs have a huge advantage. Yes?
What's the die size comparison with these generations?
So the GPUs are a little bigger die size than the typical CPUs of the same generation. And I think part of that is they use an older process technology. At least historically, GPUs have always been one process technology behind where CPUs are. But the rumor is that as of February of next year, the GPUs will overtake CPUs and they will be using a smaller process size. They'll be down to 40 nanometers instead of 45, but we'll see. Time will tell. Don't count your chickens yet. But so the memory bandwidth, once again, it's not terribly surprising. When you think about it, if I'm drawing a multi-million pixel screen where every pixel is 16 bytes, either 4 or 16 bytes, depending on whether they're integer or floating point pixels, whether they're 8 bits of color per channel, 16 bits of color per channel, or more. Basically, if I'm drawing that hundreds of times a second, that's a huge number of megabytes per second just to clear the screen, even. And then if you add all of the triangles that get drawn, and in the case of these video games, the games don't put much effort into avoiding repetitively drawing over the same area of the screen. So actually there's a lot of what's called overdraw, where you draw a triangle, it might obscure a large portion of the screen, but you might have many other triangles behind it, and you've drawn the same pixel 15 or 20 or 100 times within a hundredth of a second. So that's a lot of gigabytes a second of memory bandwidth. So the new GPUs are now, I think the GT200 boards we have in the lab are 141 gigabytes a second. The fastest CPU motherboards that exist are below 20. And those are these Intel demo boards. They're not even, you can't even buy one yet. So the machines we have in the lab are about 6 gigabytes a second in real life. And the other thing I should note is, with a multi-core CPU, if I write that simple loop I described a second ago, that for A of I equals B of I plus C of I, one core can chew up all the memory bandwidth all by itself. So if you have a simple piece of code like that, having the other three cores does you no good because there's no more memory bandwidth. So AMD's approach is a heck of a lot better. So this, I didn't even get into that, that's another thing, but for theirs, their NUMA bandwidth, one socket is still less than 10 gigabytes a second, and if you have a multi-core CPU, still one core can soak up 10 gigabytes a second without even trying very hard, especially if you write SSE code. With SSE, I can do 4 of those values at a time. One core with SSE can trivially consume all of the memory bandwidth for that whole socket. The only difference is, in an AMD machine, that's only maxing out that one socket, whereas in the Intel machine, that maxes out all the sockets, at least with front-side bus, because we've got independent memory banks on the Intel machine. Any other questions? So you might ask, well, how is it possible that the GPU has all that memory bandwidth and all of those floating-point capabilities? Well, the reason is, it's just what they spend their chip area on. If you look at the area of a modern CPU, this is, of course, a very crude schematic, but basically, the instruction decoder that takes that hugely complex x86 CISC instruction set and turns it into the actual machine ALU control signals that run the floating point units, this is a large component of the chip area on an Intel chip. If we were looking at a Spark or an Alpha or one of the old MIPS machines, this instruction decoder would probably be a lot smaller, but it would still be significant. The other factor is, on a CPU, you spend a huge, in fact, it's the majority of the chip area spent on cache. And this is, this basically goes back to the history of computer architecture. The whole point of the cache is, the CPU runs at a few gigahertz, the memory system runs at a much lower speed, there's a huge amount of memory latency. And so, if you want to be able to do something useful, after you've attempted to fetch something from main memory, if you miss the cache, you have to wait hundreds of cycles. You might sleep for 1,000 cycles with nothing to do. That makes the CPU very inefficient. So you can't do that on every single instruction. So instead, what we do is we store all the frequently accessed data in this tiny on-chip cache, sort of like your desk. Think of your desk in your office. That's your cache. If it's not in your office and it's not on your desk, it's rather difficult to do anything with it, right? So it's the same thing. The CPU basically only operates on stuff that's in this cache. And this thing runs very close to the speed of the actual processor hardware itself. So, and in fact, in modern chips, we don't just have one cache, we have several different levels of cache because it's so expensive to make this whole thing run at the full clock rate. You can't even do it. So you have an L1 cache that runs at the full speed of the chip. And then you have an L2 cache that's quite a bit slower, but it's much larger. And it's substantially slower than the L1 cache. And then if you get to even bigger machines, we'll probably have 3 or 4 levels of cache before the end of the decade. It wouldn't surprise me at all. So the thing is, though, this is what all the chip area is spent on, because this is what makes Microsoft Word or Windows run faster, is this. So, and that's who they're selling these things to, is the people running Vista. They need a huge cache because we'd spend decades writing sloppy code that uses a massive amount of memory. And so without this, all the normal stuff that sells computers will run very badly. So GPUs are a totally different world. So GPUs are about flops and memory bandwidth. They do without a cache. In fact, the only cache on the GPU are these little minuscule things that are less than 8K. They're actually, you know, sort of, they're less, the entire cache on the GPU is smaller than part of one line of the L1 cache on the CPU. It's a totally different strategy. And on the GPU, they're only used for one or two specific things. They're used for storing constants that are unchanging for an entire frame where you draw, like the transformation matrix to do the perspective rendering, things like that, or what the background color is. That's a cache value that's true for the entire, for the millions of triangles, things like that. And then there's another little cache for textures. That would be like the pattern that we draw on the walls in the video game, the little decorations, the little monster skin, things like that. That stuff's stored in a little thing called a texture unit. But the rest of the hardware is just floating point units. So it's a big, massively parallel processor, hundreds of identical floating point units. And the strategy, the reason this works, so if the GPU needs to get something from main memory, it has the same problem the CPU does. If it needs something from here, this is very slow, about, you know, hundreds of clock cycles. On the GeForce 8800, if one of these processors needs something from this memory, it's going to be delayed by 600 clock cycles. So that's, you know, you could have done 600 floating point multiply adds in that time. That's really a waste if you did nothing else. On the CPU, that is what happens. If you can't get it and it's not in the cache, you sleep. You can't do anything else. On the GPU, they take a totally different strategy. Since we have this huge array of processors, the way that the GPU deals with memory latency is rather than storing things in a frequently used cache of data, the GPU, the idea is we overwhelm it with a huge amount of work. So you may be thinking that this is your boss's strategy. You give it so much work that if it needs something from this memory and it would otherwise have to go to sleep, rather than going to sleep, it immediately takes the work it was working on, puts it aside and registers, and immediately picks up another piece of work from the pile, starts running that. And then that piece of code runs until it wants something from this terribly slow memory. Then it does the same thing. It basically does a context switch, grabs another piece of work, continues with that. So it's a throughput-oriented machine. So to fully occupy the GeForce 8800, which only had 128 of these processors, that's an older generation GPU, to fully occupy that video board, you had to have at least 768 threads. Just to keep it busy, just to keep it so it always had something to do. That was the minimum number. And to actually load that machine to the proper degree of fullness, you have to have about 12,000 threads for the previous generation hardware. For the new ones, for the GeForce GTX 280, I think you have to have about 25,000 threads to keep it busy, so that there's never any waiting for latencies. So this is a big deal. You can imagine this is a completely different programming model. This is it's alien territory if you're used to writing code with two threads and being happy. This is a totally different way of doing things. So you have to divide up your work into zillions of little tiny pieces. But the beauty is the GPU does all of this thread scheduling and hardware, and it can actually do these context switches basically for free. They're instantaneous. They're less than a clock cycle. So you pay zero penalty so long as you have enough work to keep it busy. All of these sources of latency are completely hidden.
And the RAM on the GPU, where's the CPU RAM, where's the video RAM, and where's the instruction RAM for the
GPU?
For the pair use, yes.
Ah, so this is all the
video RAM.
The video RAM is the DRAM. There is no other RAM. DRAM holds the shader code or the CUDA code. It holds the video image that you see on the screen. It holds all the textures. It holds all the constants. It holds everything. So everything is one unified, ginormous DRAM bank.
So when you're writing and you're overwriting, are you continually writing?
Yes. Yeah. They have a heavily pipelined memory system that can take many simultaneously outstanding requests. So not only do you write to the colors on the screen, but there's also a thing called a Z-buffer, a depth buffer, which holds the three-third dimension, the distance from the eye so that you can tell what's in front and what's behind, so that you know what to draw over the things in the background. All those things are being updated, and some of them, like the Z buffer, there's actually special hardware where you send it a color and the Z depth, and it's sort of a fire and forget. The processors up here say, here's the new color and here's the new depth value, and they just throw it. And then there's this in-between here, and I didn't really show you what the graphics hardware looks like. This is one of those tiny special purpose pieces of hardware that still exists on the GPU. It's sort of between these and the memory. And those are sent to this ALU that does the Z-depth comparison, and it only does the write. It's like a conditional write to that memory. And so they're dedicated units for that, separate from the ALUs. But, you know, so in the graphics case, it's much more complex than what's shown here because we have a bunch of special purpose pieces of hardware still around the periphery. But if you were to look at the percentage of chip area, this is what you're seeing here is like 80%, I would say. Just like you don't see the PCI Express bus controller on either one of these. So does that answer your question? So anyway, the point is this is a heavily multi-threaded device. It's very unique in that respect. So this is what GeForce GTX 280, this is what the chip architecture is like. You have a bunch of these little, so the whole thing is basically called a streaming processor array. That's this big box at the top. Each of these blue boxes, there are 10 of them, they are what's called the texture processor cluster. And this thing basically has a small cache. None of this is related to chip area, so the size doesn't matter here. So there's a little texture unit. This is a dedicated cache that draws the monster skin and the wall colors and the tile floor and things like that. It's where all those little images are stored and accessed. And it has a dedicated hardware interpolation for doing 1D and 2D and 3D interpolation. And then within one of those units, there are three streaming multiprocessors. So this is sort of, I guess you'd consider this to be like a CPU core, if you will. So one streaming multiprocessor has its own instruction decoder. It has an instruction cache. It has a little constant cache. It has a tiny bit of shared memory. And then it has an array of 8 single precision floating point ALUs that also do all the integer operations. It has 2 special function units, and those are where all the transcendental functions, the inverse or reciprocal square root, things like that are all computed. And then it has 1 double precision floating point unit. So you can see the ratios control the levels of performance. For graphics, we do a lot more in single precision than double precision. This is something that's new in the latest generation NVIDIA cards. Until this generation, the GeForce GTX 280 and 260, they didn't even have double precision. But of course, this isn't really needed for graphics, so they added this just for computation. This thing is special, the shared memory. This is a special, it's actually, a memory isn't a good way to describe it. It's actually a register file. So these are register speed memory locations that can be read and written by the entire array of processors collaboratively. There are basically barrier synchronization primitives in hardware so that these guys can write values into the shared memory, do a quick synchronization, know that it's in a consistent state, and then they can do things, they can continue and do things in parallel. So that's how they talk to each other, is through the shared memory. And then, of course, this has a channel that goes off to the high bandwidth DRAM interface as well. Any questions about that?
The streaming multiprocessor is supposed to be summed up so into the same instruction.
Yes, this unit, this streaming multiprocessor, there is only one instruction decoder, and that's actually a source of the efficiency of the GPU. You can see that's a huge portion of this chip area, and every core in a CPU has its own instruction decoder, right? In the GPU, we have one instruction decoder shared among a large number of ALUs. And so that means we spend a lot more of the chip's area on the ALUs than we do on the instruction decoders. Imagine if you had one instruction decoder per ALU, you'd lose half of your flops right there. So you don't want to do it that way. So that's one of the ways they get the huge flop rate. So the issue with that then is you actually have to do the same operations on all of the different data elements at the same time. Well, for computer graphics, that's perfect. And it turned, you know, for some problems, this doesn't happen. There are many problems that are difficult to express in a data parallel manner. But fortunately, a lot of the really tough supercomputing problems that are very flop intensive, they do tend to have large amounts of parallelism where you're doing very similar operations on independent data elements on a huge data set. And so that's what GPUs are very well suited for. So in my area, you know, we're basically doing molecular dynamic simulations of biological molecules. And this is an area where we use an algorithm called the N-body algorithm to calculate all the intra-atomic forces. And we want to do things like study how DNA molecules pass through little cellular membranes through membrane proteins like alpha-hemolysin, which is what this one is. And the problem is it's not even a simple linear time algorithm. These things are tremendously computationally demanding. And we would like to simulate bigger things. This is a minuscule fraction of a cell. So this is a tiny patch. If you imagine the Earth, that would be like Cape Town is right here. So this is a tiny piece. We would actually like to study how much bigger portions of the cell work. And we can see things in a computer simulation that are below what can be seen in microscopes or any other means. So being able to do these things on a computer allows us to understand how these atomic structures actually work. And that's how a lot of the, you know, the cellular mechanisms in the body are driven around these little atomic scale events. And so computer simulations are a big deal. Anyway, so one of the examples, I'm not going to explain all the physics to you guys, but basically molecules, a lot of the atomic interactions are governed by electrostatic fields, kind of like much in the way if you have two magnets and you held their south poles together, they repel. The atoms in a molecule have electrostatic field interactions that either attract or repel them from each other, and it's that dynamics that causes them to do a lot of what they do and causes them to operate the way they do. So in order to understand what makes one of these structures work, we often want to see the electrostatic field around the molecule. We want to use it as part of a calculation. So, just to give you an example, I'll show you how we do a calculation like this on the GPU. So, to calculate a multi-dimensional electrostatic field, we break up space into a bunch of little points, kind of like you could imagine a Rubik's Cube, and then every vertex, we basically calculate the electrostatic contribution from every single atom in the whole molecule. And we calculate that by basically adding the charge divided by the distance from that atom to the point we're considering. There's some constants I'm reading out for those of you that are physically inclined. But the point is, that's basically what happens. And there's a big loop that goes over all the atoms. We sum that up and we get that electrostatic field at that point. So you can imagine there's a huge number of flops. There's reciprocal square roots. And this can take a long time to calculate for a very big structure. If you have millions of atoms and billions of lattice points, that can take a while. So a simple C program that does this for one two-dimensional slice of a 3D cube would look like this. So this is a very slow piece of code. This is the slowest way you could do it in C, but it fits on one page, so that's why I'm showing. So you can see you're calculating distances. You're calculating the reciprocal square root, and if the charge is stored here, then you're accumulating that for all the atoms. And then you can see there's loops over x and y and so on. So if we implement this on the GPU, the version that I've come up with runs about 44 times faster. Is there a question back there? Okay. Runs about 44 times faster, and we break up that calculation. Instead of where we had a loop before, now we're going to launch. And every one of those loop iterations now becomes a thread. So there's no loop anymore. The loop is gone. We just give the GPU dimensions of those loops and say, run these as threads. And the hardware actually creates all the threads for us. And the thread indices will replace what had been loop iterators. So where instead of I, we have thread index dot x, or thread index dot y, or thread index dot z, or something like that. So that's how that code gets expressed. So anyway, we can do this in single precision, which is good for the first generation GPUs. It's very fast. If we care about the numerical precision, there are a couple of things we can do that improve it further, even using single precision hardware, or if we're really desperate, we can actually sum these values in double precision. The only reason that's even worth mentioning is because when you do these potentials, since they're summed with respect to their distance, the ones that are very close, the magnitudes of those numbers are very large, whereas the magnitudes of the charges that are added from a long distance away are almost zero. They're thinking of tiny little numbers. The problem is floating point arithmetic is not associated. The order that you add things in actually matters. If you add a tiny number to a huge number, because the floating point number is of limited precision, that tiny number is just gone. It's like you didn't even add it. And if you do that a million, billion, billion, trillion times, that could account for a huge source of error. So what you want to do is you want to add numbers of similar magnitude at the same time. So you have big numbers to big numbers and small numbers to small numbers, and it gives you a much more accurate result. So anyway, if you're smart, you can do these things in the right order, and even with single precision, you can get much more accurate results. And so the way this works on the GPU is we load a bunch of atom coordinates into a special memory on the GPU called the constant memory. That's that little tiny 8K or 64K cache, rather. And we express our calculation on a regular grid. Since the GPU has a fixed size number pool of processors, we want to divide these things into something that tiles evenly into the number of GPU processors. If our work size isn't exactly that size, we just pad it out with extra on the edges. And the reason for this is because GPUs are so good at launching the work and grinding through these floating point operations, it's actually faster to do the work and to throw away those excess results than it is to have the GPU fidget over those little details and just say, it's a brute force attack. GPUs are very good at brute force, just mindless number crunching. That's what they're great at. And so we do this calculation. It grinds each one of these little string of multiprocessors, loops over all the atoms, and they consider different independent grid points. So each one of these little grid points basically maps to a thread. And so it loops over all those atoms, sums them up. And because this memory is a fixed size, we have to do this many times. We have to do it as many times as it takes until all of the atoms for the whole molecule have been added up. And then when we're finished, we get this electrostatic potential field. We throw away the stuff on the edges. This, basically, the CPU then copies out the part of the result that we're interested in, and then we get the answer. And so this is basically the way this gets mapped in the GPU. The GPU expresses work in these units called thread blocks. One thread block gets run on one of those streaming multiprocessors. So this would be the work that goes on one of those cores, if you will, and it's composed of a grid of anywhere from 64 to 256 threads. Like I say, if our work size doesn't divide evenly into one of these thread blocks, we do the work anyway and we just throw it away in the end. So does that make sense? And now, just like with the CPU, we can do a lot of things to improve the performance of the code. And some of that is, in the CPU implementation, we would have optimized the code by removing redundant operations inside that inner loop. So if I were to go back and look at this CPU code, in that inner loop, we're only operating over the x dimension every iteration, so it's actually wasteful to recalculate the y, dz, and then their squared partial distance components, right? So if we were tuning this code, we'd pull that stuff outside of the inner loop, and then the inner loop is much tighter, runs a lot faster. So the same idea, we can use that concept on the GPU, but in order to do that, we have to consume some of our parallelism. So we trade, and we take the number of threads we would have spawned. Instead of having every thread do one lattice point, we can have it do four. And so we have it reuse some of what it calculated, not a lot of times, but at least four times. And that can improve the sequential performance per thread. The disadvantage of that approach is if we didn't have enough work to saturate the GPU, this type of optimization actually consumes more work per thread, so we might not have enough threads to keep the GPU busy. So this is a good idea if you have a massive amount of concurrency, but if you don't have enough work to keep the GPU busy, it's actually not what you want to do. So this is what it would look like. This is the GPU kernel changed to do four of those grid points at a time. So this is actually the code that runs on the GPU verbatim. So as you can see, it looks very much like standard C, except for you have these wonderful GPU-specific instructions like reciprocal square root. So the way that looks in terms of how the data set is laid out, one special thing we do, the GPU, those to get that 140 gigabytes a second of memory bandwidth, it likes to do memory operations in big groupings. So it wants to read or write groups of data in, say, 64-byte chunks. And so in order to allow it to do that, we have each thread skip a certain number of memory locations. And then it and its neighboring threads end up doing a big band of memory transfers all at once. And it's in a big packed block. And that's how we get the peak memory performance. So this tuned version gets about 291 gigaflops on those GeForce 8800 GTX cards. That's actually quite impressive. The peak performance, theoretically, of the best Intel chip you can buy is somewhere down below 150, as I recall. And if you actually write this code, it's I think the peak gigaflops it gets is around 5.9, something like that. So it's a huge speed-up advantage. And so this is using that same unrolling trick, but instead of by a factor of 4, it's a factor of 8. So another observation about this, the thing I mentioned before is very important. You'll see if I plot the runtime for doing a calculation on the CPU, you notice it's logarithmic. It goes up dramatically with the size of the problem. If I plot the runtime for the CPU versus the runtime for the GPU, in this region, for a very tiny problem, the CPU is actually faster. And the reason for this is to get the GPU started doing a calculation, you have to copy the data off of the CPU to the GPU. So there's a special CUDA memcopy, and you copy the data to the GPU, you get it ready, and then you launch the kernel. Well, that takes a little bit of time. The time that you did all that, you could have actually calculated very tiny problems. Once you get past that point, from then on, the GPU is faster. But what's interesting to notice, this relatively flat graph here, up until this point here, the GPU is actually not being fully utilized. Only one or two of the processors on the GPU has any work. Until we get out to about here, we haven't given enough threads of work to the GPU to fully keep it busy. So until its runtime increases substantially, the GPU is actually mostly idle. And so this is what I was saying about giving the GPU enough work. Once you give it enough work and it achieves its full potential, then it's running, up in this range, it's running about 40 times faster. Yes?
What did you say percentage of the development time is spent figuring out how to schedule stuff so that you're using the GPU fully?
Zero. I mean, in my case, the problems we have are so large that this was never even an issue for me. But if you were doing something that was much smaller. So for example, we did have one problem for a Cray electron microscopy. Somebody wanted to do an image registration algorithm where they match different images, align them, into grids. And for their problem, their problem size would have been the equivalent to something like this. And so the straightforward way of writing the code would have severely underutilized the GPU, so that they did get a speed up, but it was like a speed up of 2, not a speed up of 40. And so the problem was for them, they had written a very large piece of code, but the available amount of work at any given moment was very small. So in order to fully benefit from the GPU, they would have to turn their code sort of inside out so that rather than having a tiny amount of work at any given moment, they would have a huge collection of work. Another strategy you can take is you can collect the work units one at a time. And like this, you can change the CPU code to sort of defer the work. So rather than doing it when it's presented to you, you collect those work requests, you pile them up. And when you've accumulated enough to be worth your while, then you launch it on the GPU while you continue doing something else on the CPU. And then you get the full benefit.
Do you have to do anything about cooling on your part?
No, I should have shown you. I took it out of this. I'll show you another slide at the end of the talk. We put three GeForce 8800 GTXs in a normal desktop PC case, and we were very concerned. because, for one, I was not convinced that our power supply was up to the test, because it was the power supply that came with the machine. It was a 700-watt power supply, so I had some idea what we were getting into. But it did generate a lot of heat, and I was really worried, because this was when we were first starting, we were giving a demo. Demos are when everything fails, right? So we had this machine for about 3 weeks, and we were going to give a big demo, and as it turns out, it's in a room with no air conditioning. I'm like, oh, this is pressing our luck. And the machine gets very warm, but the GPUs have their own cooling fans inside, and they're actually sufficient diameter. They can really blow a lot of hot air. But I will tell you, you can actually burn your hand on the GPUs after you turn the machine off and their fan stops turning. The heat isn't completely gone from that GPU. If it's been running flat out and you just power off the machine and then you go to pull it out of the machine, you can burn your fingers quite easily, because all that, there's a lot of heat capacity in those heat sinks, and it hasn't really drawn it out of the chips. But anyway, they will run in, I don't know how many degrees Celsius, but they run fine even in, packed in a machine like that, 80 degree or 85 degree temperature air.
Is this single or double precision?
So this is all single precision, like I said.
Double precision performance.
I would say if you do it all in double precision, it's about 1/4 the speed, if I remember right. The thing about double precision, so you saw there's 8 times as many single precision units as there are double precision units. One of the interesting things, though, is even the most floating point intensive code there is only about 50% floating point instructions, because they're always addressing instructions, pointer addition, loop indices, all these other things in any real piece of code. So even though you would expect it maybe to be like 1/8 as fast, in reality, since those same 8 single precision units are also used for the integer arithmetic, if you're doing pure double precision, that actually frees all of them up just to do the integer work, and it actually isn't quite as big of a speed yet. So, and that's the way it is now. So I would expect also, as computing becomes a bigger portion of what GPUs are used for, they'll be able to justify spending more of the chip area on units that are capable of doing double precision. I mean, this is the first hardware that had double precision. I think they're playing a wait and see. If you're NVIDIA and you make your millions selling GPUs for video games, it's risky for them to add anything to the hardware that allows their competitor to have, if they spend it on a double precision unit, that means they didn't spend it on something else that is graphics specific. And if their competitor spends it on, more shader units or whatever else, that might give them a performance advantage for what sells the majority of cars. So it's a very delicate decision, deciding what ratios of hardware to put on all these chips. And I think they'll just have to, it'll be an evolutionary thing. They'll add more and more of what the computing people want as we show them the money, if you will.
Has it been used for character recognition?
I don't know the answer to that. I will say this, if you go, I know mostly about NVIDIA stuff. There are people doing things with AMD cards too. I know that there are a lot of computer vision people using GPUs now with CUDA and Brook. I think I heard that the ATI guys had a demo where they have gesture recognition, where a guy holds his hand in front of the video camera and he can basically use it like a 3D mouse, and this is able to be done in real time without any special markers painted on your hand, things like that. I would think that if they can do that, that OCR shouldn't be too hard. I know that they've done encryption, so they've been doing, they've implemented MD5 in CUDA. There are actually something like 4 or 5 different versions that are out there. They're open source that you can play with. People have been doing movie compression, decompression on the GPUs. So there are all kinds of things. Any other questions? So this is an example of the runtime. So here's the peak performing SSE CPU So this is using one core with four-way SSE versus the older GeForce 8800 GTX, and you can see the relative performance. So this is 0.9 billion atom evaluations per second for the CPU, and about 40, or is either like 39.9 or 40.1, I forget what the number is on the best one, but that ends up being about 291 gigaflops. I should point out that the first version of the code I ever wrote, so this was actually my first CUDA program, the first version I wrote ran 15 times faster than the CPU. Now, you know, I had never run anything on the GPU before, so I just assumed that my code was broken. And I thought, no, this can't be right. There's no way. It's just aborting, or it's, you know, terminating early or something. There's no way it's actually running. And it wasn't until I played with it for about 30 minutes and wrote code to actually check the numbers that I was getting back and comparing them versus the CPU that I realized, no, it really is that fast. And then it's kind of like somebody handing you an alien device, and you're like, this can't be possible. How is it doing this? You know, I thought, no, maybe I forgot to clear the memory from the last time through. That's what it is. It's still got the old answer. No, it was really working. So I think I spent about 4 hours to get the first version of the code working, and most of that was just reading the manual and learning how to copy the data onto the GPU and get it back and all that stuff. So running the same code on four GPUs, these are NVIDIA quadruplex boxes. Each one of these has two GPUs in it, and it's attached to an AMD multiprocessor machine. So we have four GPUs per node. So running on one of those with the old quadruplex, they have the Quadro FX 5600 cards in it, we're able to get just over one teraflop, which is about 176 times faster than the Intel QX 6700 for with SSE. And with the new GPUs, we're almost at 2 teraflops, which is 271 times faster than the same reference. So that's actually quite good. Now, I won't go into all the details, but for a lot of this is a quadratic time algorithm, so it's very floating point intensive. There are other algorithms that are more work efficient, that are linear time algorithms that use various approximations. And on those, we don't get the 44x speedup, we get about a 26x speedup, but it's still a huge speedup, so it's really interesting. And I'll tell you a little bit about how we do that stuff in a minute. So to make this instead of quadratic time, to make it linear time, we actually don't do a loop over all the atoms, we only do a loop over the atoms within a certain distance of the grid point we're interested in. Oops, somehow I missed that. I guess I must have deleted the matching slide, so never mind. I'll tell you that if you're still interested, I'll tell you afterwards. So I'll tell you a different thing. So one of the other interesting things we do, you know, you saw that simulation of that DNA going through that nanopore. We write another program called NAMD, and it does those big molecular dynamics simulations. So normally NAMD runs on huge supercomputers with up to 2,000 processors. Those runs are not uncommon. To give you an example, we ran various simulations like on an SGI Altix using several hundred processors for 3 months straight, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it's a big problem. So in this calculation, we calculate forces between atoms. We distribute little cubes of space to the different processors in a big supercomputer or on a cluster, and they communicate with the other processors, exchange atom positions. They calculate the forces on each box of atoms against each other, and then that is used to move the positions of the atoms in a the next time step, and this is repeated millions and millions and millions of times, and that's how we end up with one of those simulations. So, of the work that we do in molecular dynamics, there are all kinds of forces that are calculated, angle forces, bonded forces, long-range electrostatic forces, but what the bulk of the work is done is calculating the forces between atoms that are very close to each other. And so if you see the numbers here, that sort of indicates the magnitude of the amount of work in each of these different things. So this is the thing that will pay off for us to accelerate. That's what I was saying at the beginning. This is about 95% of the work in a typical molecular dynamics calculation. So this is what we want to put on the GPU. If we were to make that go infinitely fast, and it run about 20 times faster. So this is what actually runs on the GPU. This is the code. This would be about 95% of the runtime on the normal CPU version of the code. Now, this is very evil and hairy, and I don't expect anyone to understand any of it. But the point is, it's basically C. This is normal C code. The only thing that's weird that's sort of GPU-specific are things like using the texture unit. But basically, it's a lookup table. That's all you really need to know. For purposes of computing, the GPU's texture hardware is just a special purpose piece of hardware that lets us do table lookups and interpolations very efficiently. But the rest of it, you see there's a lot of flops, there's a lot of little integer indexing, things like that. These are all things that the GPU is quite good at. So that's what a heavy-duty GPU kernel looks like.
Yours is tailored specifically for NVIDIA, this stuff won't work on.
That's correct, yeah. But, you know, the algorithms that we're using in this code wouldn't work on the software stack that AMD is making available presently anyway. So we would have to change the actual algorithm to work on their particular hardware. But this is actually relatively easy to do on NVIDIA's. The key difference between the software that NVIDIA has now and what AMD has, you remember that shared register file that allows them to communicate? The AMD programming language, Brook Plus, it doesn't have an analogous feature to that, and that actually restricts you quite a bit in what you can do in terms of having the processing units talk to each other. And for some algorithms, that's not an impediment, but for others, like a lot of the stuff we do, we make heavy use of that, and so it's a big deal for us. So, but I will say that there is a cadre of companies working on this thing called OpenCL. And the specifications I've seen, I mean, it's a draft thing that they're still working on, it looks very similar to CUDA. So there's a very high probability that OpenCL and CUDA will look almost the same. If that's the case, then it ends up being a minor issue. So but we'll just have to wait and see. Right now, I would say from a programming language standpoint, the CUDA stuff is far and away the best thing that's presently available. And it's probably going to remain that way for at least another year or more. Now, this is a fast-changing field, so you know you can't write one of these things and expect it to be this way for 20 years. But I think at least within the case of NVIDIA, their stuff is available now, their software works, and their stuff will be backwards compatible with itself, so you don't have to worry about porting it until OpenCL really starts to take off and we can start looking at that as a serious option. So this is a million atom virus structure. This is one of the big things we ran that simulation on for several months. Running that on a GPU, there's a bunch of different things involved, but we're running that on a cluster of GPUs with between 4 and 60 GPUs. The work is decomposed into two parts. There's the part of the work that only the node only needs to have its own data for, and there's the part of the work that it has to communicate with its neighbors for. So that's the remote work. And its neighbors depend on its previous calculations in order to do their calculations. So this remote work is important because we want to do it first. If we do it slowly, then we not only delay our own results, but we hold back all of the other nodes that depend on us. So it's important we do that first. One of the things that's interesting with a small number of nodes, you'll see that there's a huge amount of local work and a very small amount of remote work that we have to communicate with our neighbors. As we go to larger and larger and larger numbers of processors, that situation, eventually they become nearly equal, and if we had a much bigger GPU cluster, it would actually be reversed. The majority of the work would be remote, and we'd only have a tiny fraction of the work that's just local to the node itself. So if you look at the runtime, it takes a half a second, on the GPU, and about a second per iteration on a small number of GPUs. As we get up to a larger count, we're down to 400ths of a second on the GPU versus about 800ths of a second for all the work the GPU and the CPU are added today. And so the overall speed up we're getting versus an equivalent simulation on just CPUs, it's about a factor of 7. This is for the older G4 GeForce 8800 series hardware. Factor of 7 for the small number of GPUs and a factor of 5.5 is 60. The important point to note here is at this sort of speed up, we have 4 GPUs per cluster node. That's, if we get a speed up of 7, that means it's like having 28 CPU cores in one box. That's a lot of horsepower, but there's only one network card. So that's in sort of an out of balance situation. That's not typically when we build a big supercomputer, the network is actually a major factor in the architecture of the machine. In this case, this was an experimental cluster where we weren't worried about it yet. We were just happy that we got any speed up at all. But this is an interesting result because it means as we start using GPUs to accelerate a lot of scientific codes, we'll have to be very careful about how many GPUs per node, how fast the network interconnect has to be, because otherwise, like in our calculation, by the time we get up to 60 GPUs, there's a lot of network lag that's slowing this down at this point. The GPUs would be perfectly happy to do more work, but they spend a lot of their time waiting for the network.
So the answer is to have a combined card, which includes both cubes and Ethernet.
Well, you know, I've been twisting it pretty strong. And I don't know, you know, they do have a little sly SLI interconnect that they use to gang several GPUs together for these video games so that you can basically collectively double or quadruple the rendering speed by buying more cards, and it basically runs them in parallel. For the present day GPUs, only a small fraction of the signals are sent over the wires on this SLI interconnect, and the rest are done through the motherboard, actually, through the PCI Express bus. And what's interesting is, you know, NVIDIA made a lot of special custom chips. It used to be to get a motherboard that would do SLI, you had to buy a special motherboard. And the reason was they had special hardware on the motherboard to let the GPUs talk to each other without the CPU being involved. As it's become harder and harder for NVIDIA to get companies like Intel to cooperate, they have had to resort to doing some of these things in hardware. So if you have an Intel motherboard, there isn't any special hardware, and they have to do tricks in the video drivers to make that work. So it makes you wonder, with things changing in that way, maybe they'll beef up that network link on the GPUs, and then you could get away with, you could eliminate the InfiniBand cards altogether and just have the GPUs as both the computation and the communication. That would be really exciting. The trick is, GPUs are a commodity item, so you can't do anything that is costly and doesn't benefit the average Joe that buys it for a video game. So you have to find a way to use it for a video game. If you can find a way to use InfiniBand or some onboard network for your video games, for your ultra-low latency LAN party, I'm not really sure what. If you can find a way to do that, to come up with a use case where it benefits both the high-end HPC users as well as the video games, then you really have something.
Streaming high-efficiency.
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question. Yeah. Although I will say the bandwidths of the highest high-definition TV are a pittance compared to InfiniBand. So InfiniBand is gigabytes a second.
So we need bigger TVs.
So to summarize that, with the cluster at NCSA, we're able to run on 60 GPUs. We're getting the performance that we would get if we had a cluster of 330 CPUs. Significant speed up. These graphs show the runtime for the CPU, if we ran it on the CPU only. Then there's the blue, which is the runtime for the GPU, and with the GPU, and the percentage of that runtime that is the GPU itself. So you can see the total time, about 50% of it is left after we've accelerated with the GPU. About 50% of it is the GPU, and the other 50% is the remaining CPU work. This is a hugely faster result than the CPU by itself.
Yeah. About 1 second per step earlier. These steps are picoseconds.
Okay. It's a femtosecond.
Femtosecond.
Yeah. So you can see why we have to run for months and months and months. Actually, we ran a simulation recently. I think it's the longest simulation anybody's ever run. We started it in October of 2007, and it didn't finish until March 12, 2008. And it ran on 384 processors, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the total simulated time in the molecular dynamics run, this was a protein folding simulation, the The total simulated time was 6.9 microseconds.
So, did you fail 5 minutes before the leave?
No, well, that was on CPUs. If we did this on GPUs, it would have been, instead of taking 6 months, it would have taken... No, the mean time between failure is a major consideration for long-running stuff. But I would say, but here's another thing. We don't blindly just run this stuff. There are checkpoint files that get written once every 5 minutes or less. Because on a big machine, you know, the larger the run, if we ran this instead of on 384 processors, if we ran it on 1,000 or on 4,000, the likelihood of any component failure goes up dramatically. For example, there was a run, somebody wrote a paper on at supercomputing last year. They ran a molecular dynamics calculation on a blue gene machine in Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And it ran on, I think it was either 100 or 200,000 cores for a million CPU years. And the mean time between failure on that machine at that scale is 5 minutes. And so they actually had to change their code. The failure mode that was the highest likelihood was L1 uncorrectable PCC error on the L1 cache. So what they would do is, since that was a far higher likelihood of failure than any other failure mode, they changed their code. So they, because they had the cooperation of IBM, they changed the kernel for the blue gene so that rather than, you know, basically aborting and rebooting that node, what they would do instead is when they got an uncorrectable L1 error, it would send the process a signal. So instead of killing your code gets a signal interrupting what you're doing. If that's a uncorrectable L1 error, what it does is it basically aborts the part of the code it's in, recopies all of the data from, they had a special cache clear instruction, so they could basically wipe out the contents of L1 cache and then reload all of their data from a saved time step in main memory. And they could restart that one node in their dynamics code without holding up any of the others. So you could have a failure on one out of those 200,000 nodes. It would be a brief hiccup, but it doesn't require relaunching that job. You can imagine having a queuing system just start the process on 200,000 nodes is a huge ordeal. It is not something that you do in a few seconds. It takes minutes here, you know, to launch a job like that. So being able to recover from transient errors like that is a huge thing. So that's going to be a big deal with GPUs too, because whereas a CPU, you know, it's easy to make caches that have error correction built into the hardware. Doing that for floating point units is tough. And the difference is where a CPU, most of your exposed area that can get hit by a cosmic ray or something like that is cache. On the GPU, there is no cache. If you get hit by a cosmic ray, you're going to get a bad result from your multiplier or something like that. And those, how do you detect that? So that's, you either have to do redundant calculations. So either they put double the number of floating point units in the GPU and just vote on the answer, which is what they do for like space, space hardware like satellites and things like that. You have redundant hardware and you vote either two-way or three-way votes to decide who's right or some other scheme like that. But we're not yet there yet. At the moment, the mean time between failure of the GPUs is as low or lower than most of the software that's running on them. So I would say software is presently the weak link, either the host operating system or the video driver. Well, more than likely than anything, the application itself probably has more bugs than there are cosmic rays. So, same code running on the GT200 GPUs gets, per GPU, it's 9 times faster. So, 8 GT200, that's a GeForce GTX 280, 8 of those cards together run 72 times faster than they put on a single CPU core. That's actually quite a bit faster, 32% faster than the older generation GPUs. I did do some tests using double precision for this calculation because it's actually much more important for molecular dynamics. Once again, the sensitive part of that code is adding forces. Once again, the big, you know, adding large magnitude forces to small ones. So doing that in double precision improves the accuracy of the result significantly. Doing that costs only 8% of the overall performance, so that's relatively inexpensive. It's hardly even noticeable. It's buried among, you know, like if we fix the load imbalance between the work distributed to different GPUs, that would completely cancel out whatever performance impact double precision had. So here's sort of a list of other things that we've done on GPUs over the last year and a half since we started playing with them. You can see the range in speedups we're getting. We have some new stuff that's actually not on here yet. It's more in the mid-30s, so they're quite speedy. So the take-home from all this is you need a lot of independent calculations to keep a GPU busy. One of the beauties of GPUs is, you know, you saw that parallelism, that's like the inner body of one loop ends up being one thread. You know, that's a tiny amount of little work. That is something that is so small you would never... MPI or other parallel or OpenMP, for example. Another thing is that GPUs have massive amounts of floating point hardware, so what you end up actually worrying about is keeping it busy. And so that means getting it the data that it needs to do the calculations that you're trying to do. Another trick that you can use that's been very good for us is since the GPU likes working on regular, evenly tiled arrays of things, it's very beneficial to use the CPU to sort of pre-process the work that's being handed to the GPU so that the GPU always has full blocks of work. And then you can just have the CPU do the cleanup after the fact. You can have the CPU do the cleanup work in the background while the GPU is running. And that basically allows the GPU to get a much higher fraction of its peak performance. And if you have nothing better to do with the CPU, then it's a perfectly valid way of using it. And of course, because the GPU is sort of, once you've launched its calculation, you don't need to wait for it. You can go off and do other things so that in our parallel jobs on these clusters, the CPU can go back and do all the communication, message passing, and check on other things that have to be done independent of the GPU. And it can occasionally, you can either have it pull the GPU or various other schemes to determine when the GPU has finished what it's working on. And so, there you go. Any questions? Yeah.
Well, very recently, the message was that the only heavy criticism you should be doing in the EGAs and that kind of thing. Do you not think GPUs are a much better answer because they're just simple to work?
I think the GPUs were, FPGAs were interesting to people because there were, you could make it, you could basically code up the circuit to solve your problem. The difficulty with FPGAs always was that not many people know VHDL, nor do they want to learn. There are a lot of the issues. You can't write in a programming language really and have it just run on an FPGA. You end up having to know a lot more about hardware architecture than you ever wanted to know. And not all FPGAs are the same. If you have an FPGA that just has multiplexers and it has no floating point hardware at all, you're going to burn up a lot of your chip area building a floating point unit out of the programmable units on the chip, whereas if you have a board that has a couple of dedicated fixed function floating point units, it's a lot easier to use those as a building block for a bigger circuit. There's a lot of variation. The FPGAs always had the same problem that we see with the older GPUs, where there were a lot of different ways to program them. There isn't one FPGA development toolkit. Every vendor has their own tools, their own compilers, their own stuff, and it gets pretty involved. The fact is, like when I was a graduate student, I did program FPGAs, and tools have improved a little bit, but it's not. I would expect a different world now, but it isn't that different. They haven't gotten as much better as I would have expected. And another factor was, in 1994, you could get FPGAs that ran at 100 megahertz, and at the time that was pretty impressive. But it's like 2008 now, and the peak clock rate of FPGAs is not that different from what it was. It's about 500 megahertz, but that's nowhere near the scale of performance increase that we see with GPUs. And the other factor is the cost. A dedicated board with a bunch of FPGA chips currently costs a lot of money. For that amount of money, I could buy a flotilla of video game GPUs. And when they're too old and tired to do number crunching, I could hand them out to people to use on their desks. where they can be recycled for something else. So that I think for our purposes, the GPU is always going to be the logical route because it's a commodity device. You know, like I said, there are 100 million GPUs in the field. You can go buy a software development kit at Best Buy or your local, you know, video game store. You don't have to spend $10,000 to get the right tools and licenses for all the stuff that you need to do FPGA development efficiently.
But you just need to learn about the architecture.
That's true, but it's nowhere near as coding the gates yourself. You know, those are two completely different levels of abstraction. The other factor is, I think a lot of the FPGA devices, you know, FPGAs really, their mission in life is to serve as glue logic so that people don't have to re-spin chips if they made a mistake on something. So FPGAs are sort of all over the place, but they're meant to be cheap. They're not meant to be fast. And the same is true of, you know, like one of the things, the cell chip was very promising initially because at the time it was announced, there was really nothing like it. But what I came to realize is the cell chip is meant for consumer electronics devices like DVD players, the PlayStation 3, things like this. What drives the cell chip is not making a new revision of it every 3 months that has better performance. What drives the cell chip is making it less and less and less and less expensive. Because they, you know, if they use the cell chip as a multimedia embedded processor, the way they make their money is by minimizing the cost of that thing, not by, you know, any other means. So I think, you know, where we thought cell was going to be a very promising chip at first, I think in reality it looks to me like it's not being driven by the same market forces that GPUs are. So long as people don't decide that GPUs are fast enough, they will continue to be more closely aligned to what we want for high performance computing, because they'll keep revving the clock speeds, they'll keep increasing the number of floating point units. I've heard, you know, numbers like we should expect massive speed increases on GPUs in the next 2 years. So, yeah, you know, all this depends on who gets affected by the financial crisis. Well, those things have changed the plans of many companies already, but I think that the odds are in favor of the GPUs due to their commodity nature. And I don't think they're going anywhere. If you look at the history of accelerators for high-performance computing, the only accelerator that's really lasted a long time of all of them is the GPU. How many of you have encryption accelerators in your machines? Yeah, that's what I thought. You know what I'm saying? So this is the thing. There's a market there that supports the continued hardware development. And hardware development is so expensive nowadays. If you don't have a huge market to support every new chip design, you can't do it anymore. So GPUs are one of the few things that has a big enough market to support that. Somebody else had a question.
Are you at all involved in distributing the sort of work to simulate a few seconds of this physics on a distributed scale? Did you think about folding one
subproject? Yeah, so we're not doing any of those things because the type of simulations we do are sequentially dependent. You can't, like a lot of the things they do are doing things like measuring how much force it takes to break something, or they were watching some dynamic process that they wouldn't see, or it's so incredibly rare it won't happen unless it's sort of coerced. Some of they call these steered molecular dynamic simulations. I wouldn't say that it's impossible, but as far as I know, how to do that in a distributed computing manner. But things like protein folding, like Vijay Panda's folding at home, you know, there are a lot of things that are like that. The SETI at home, folding at home, all that stuff. Folding at home has already been running on GPUs for some time now. They have a client that works in CUDA now as well. And they get pretty impressive speed ups. I don't remember what the exact number is versus their CPU version, but it's, you know, somewhere north of 60, if I remember right. So it's quite impressive.
About 4 or 5 slides ago, you had a slide that showed the performance related to CPUs. Can you just go into that slide, please?
Sure. For which code? This one?
I think it was just before this. Yes. This 8 GD200s. So it was on a single CPU core.
That's right.
Having 72 core. unrealistic. So I'm wondering what the price comparison would be to get the same performance.
Well, I don't know where you can buy a 72 GPU.
Well, I can supply you with a 64 core machine for under 200,000. That's why
I can build an 8 node GPU cluster for under 4,000.
That's under 4,000.
Yeah.
$4,000.
Sorry. So you're talking RANs, what is that, 20,000? Yeah, so it's probably a factor of 5 difference in price performance. Now, the difference is I can't run the same code. You know, that's really the issue. Is I'm willing to use unusual hardware to get a huge speed up, and I get a resulting benefit in terms of the price of the hardware, the compute density, the performance per watt. That's another advantage that GPUs have, is they use a lot less power per floating point operation. But I think that depends on what the host machine is. The other factor is, this is another thing to keep in mind, we didn't actually time this versus one core. Actually, the speed up would have been bigger versus one core, because when you actually use all the cores, they compete for that fixed main memory bandwidth per socket. This is the most favorable number for the CPU that I can give you. This is a best case scenario for the CPU, and in reality is going to be worse than that for this number of GPUs at least. If we had a much larger number of GPUs and CPUs, the network would actually be the thing that determines the winner, not the accelerator or the CPUs. So at a small scale, the other factor is I can, what's more big and more interesting is, I can put 4 GPUs in one machine. That's like having, 40 or 50 cores, and I can do that in a normal size desktop machine with no crazy stuff, except for I do have to have a little thicker cable for the blowout. But, just this, a special power supply and 4 GPUs and a lot of the motherboards that are coming out now. So we have, at our lab at home, we have several machines that have 3 GPUs in them, and it's not too hard to set that up. The major factor is just how fast each of the PCI Express slots is. A lot of motherboards, if you put 4 GPUs in them, then the speed of each individual slot drops from 16x down to 8x, so that impacts the speed at which you can communicate between the host and the GPU. But hopefully they'll be coming out with motherboards pretty soon and aren't limited in that way.
Are you finding that is actually automated?
Not really, because actually, remember that main memory bandwidth of the host machine? PCI Express, with these new boards, it's possible to transfer about 6 gigabytes a second in either direction with one GPU. Now, if I have 4 GPUs, even if every slot was able to do full PCI Express 2.0 x16 bandwidth, the fact is the host machine's memory system can't go that fast. And so I can't buy a motherboard where the memory system is able to sustain 24 gigabytes a second. So even if I had full bandwidth slots, it wouldn't do me any good because the memory can't keep up. So that's a funny, when they start building better motherboards that now either NUMA or they have higher main memory bandwidth, then it will get more of an issue whether or not they're full X8, or if they're full X16 or if they're dropped down to X8 speed. Yeah.
You mentioned using the more game-oriented cards and the professional Quadro cards.
Uh-huh.
Is there any real difference in performance?
In the old cards, there wasn't much difference in performance. So the first generation of GeForce 8800 and the first generation Tesla cards were basically identical. The Tesla cards, the only difference was they had more memory. So rather than having 768 megabytes of memory, they had 1.5 gigabytes of memory, so they had twice as much memory. With the new generation of cards, the difference is more significant. The Tesla compute-specific cards, they're in these 1U cages wherein you can buy individual cards. They also have more memory as before, but now it's 4 gigabytes in the Tesla version versus 1 gigabyte in the normal video game version. And the other difference is that the Tesla cards run at a higher clock speed. So they run at 1.5 gigahertz, whereas the game-oriented ones only run at 1.3. The other difference in all cases is that all of the Tesla versions of the cards, I'm told, are tested by NVIDIA themselves in California by their CUDA engineers or whoever. whereas the video game cards are manufactured by the companies that sell them, and there's whatever testing it is, whatever those companies do. And for video game cards, maybe they're not, you know, the other difference, I think the Tesla cards that NVIDIA sells, they've tested, they are required to use the exact memory chips and so on that NVIDIA specifies. With the game oriented parts, the vendors choose all those parts and they can choose whatever they want, but it doesn't cause them to upset their customers, whatever that is.
And that shouldn't make any difference
for your purposes? For our purposes, for the molecular dynamics, no. Because we run on these huge clusters, actually the amount of computation for a number of atoms is so large that so a million atom structure is only what does that work out to 100? That's like, yeah, it's 12 megabytes is the majority of the data for the whole thing. So you can see it's minuscule. It fits in a CPU, it fits pretty much on chip, in the on-chip cache. For the GPU, it's practically no data at all. And but there's a massive amount of floating point arithmetic going on for that small amount of data. But there are other calculations, like the one in the beginning, doing these electrostatic fields. When we get to large size problems, like doing the electrostatic field for that virus, that's a perfect example. That virus is so large that it won't fit on the video game length cards. To do the full virus in a single pass without juggling a lot of stuff around, you need more than a gigabyte of memory. It's about 1.5 gigabytes of memory, so it barely fits on the first generation cards. We're actually now, so I should point out this electrostatic field calculation. This is the first step in building those models of these big structures so that they can even run on these supercomputers. So in 2011, they're going to build a supercomputer at University of Illinois that has 200,000 cores. And there are various groups competing to run on this machine, but one of the simulations they'll do has 100 million atoms. So it'll have 100 times, this is a million, so it'll be 100 times bigger than this virus. The electrostatic field calculation on the GPUs for this virus took about 27 minutes to see, and that's on the GPU with the 40-some X speed up, right? So to do that on the CPU would take an eternity. Or a very large cluster is how we used to do it. You can imagine where the simulations are talking about these big membrane domains or a big photosynthetic unit that's a huge light bulb shaped thing that's found in pond scum at the bottom of lakes. It's interesting. Believe it or not, pond scum are very useful to learn from because it's those pond scum living at the very bottom of the lake in the very muddiest, slimiest water that have the most efficient photosynthesis because they get so little light down there. So those are the ones we study to understand how plants turn light into energy. And so anyway, it's interesting there. If you want to study that thing, that will be a 70 million atom simulation. And they're just building the structures now to do simulations of how fast it will run on a huge machine so that they can prove that it will even be feasible to do that simulation in 2011 when the machine's actually available. And so we'll be using the GPUs. What's that? So we'll be using the GPUs to do all the electrostatic field calculations to build those models to get everything ready to run on the huge machine when it becomes available.
Is there any estimate of how long it will run?
I'm sorry?
Is there any estimate of how long the simulation will run?
Yeah, the scientists doing the simulation have had to do back-of-the-envelope calculations of all those things. And, you know, a big issue for simulations of biological structures, you remember I said we ran one of the longest simulations ever, and it was for 6.9 microseconds of simulated time. And that was, you know, hundreds of millions of time steps over several months, right? Well, the problem is a lot of biological processes take milliseconds. And so there will be some simulations that even with the biggest machine on the earth, it isn't possible. It isn't feasible to do because you'd have to run for the rest of your natural life to do it. And so there's a limit to what things we can simulate with full all-atom detail. And we have to use other schemes to simulate those things where you take statistical approaches rather than a direct brute force simulation. There are a lot of ways people do these things. But they have to, when they propose one of these big simulations, they have to actually show that a in the amount of time that they can reasonably simulate on a given size machine, that whatever biological process they're studying is, you know, likely to occur. And the other thing is they don't just run one simulation. Really, to prove that this is really how something works, they end up running a lot of repeated simulations to gather more evidence that, yes, this is reliable, this really does happen. It isn't an accident or a bug in the code. It really does, you know, this virus really works this way, or this protein really does unfold this way. It has to be reproducible. That's a big deal. That's one of the problems, is we have a lot of these things we want to be able to do. There's only so many flops in the world that can be used for these computer simulations, and so they have to be very careful how they allocate those things. So this is why you spend 3 years preparing your simulation and proving that it's doable and gathering all this evidence before you spend what could be millions of CPU years on running that thing. Because if you're running that, then somebody else can't run another simulation. There are lots of cool astronomy calculations that people want to do, huge data mining things. If you're running, then somebody else isn't running. That's another thing that excites me about GPUs, though, that I feel very good, because if I can save the world a few million watts of electricity, that 200,000 core machine will use 20 million watts of electricity or something in that range. If you can run something on a few GPUs on a desk with a cheap piece of hardware that you can afford to own yourself, then you're freeing all those big machines up for things that cannot run anywhere else. And so that's another reason you should write code for GPUs, because it's good for the world.
There's a part of it
that
you
can enable. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. You can do it on laptops now. All of these new Macs have GPUs that can do CUDA. Yeah, if you type NVIDIA CUDA and look at the web page. It's really cool. And the number of different applications that have been run on the GPUs increases every day. NVIDIA has a whole web page that have links to all the different people's codes and their talks. A lot of the people doing this stuff are releasing it in open source, so it's really pretty cool.
This is a question, how do you make the difference? If you are, we can continue this discussion.
How many of these tall hills do I have to carry my bowling ball around with?
Well, you put in my boots.
Okay. Yeah, see, the problem is, while I'm in South Africa, this is my office, and so it's not really the lightest thing.
Thank you to John.
Yeah.